Welcome to this special briefing from the House Small Business Committee on behalf of WIP and Give Me Five. WIP, for any of you who may be unfamiliar with us, is a national nonpartisan public policy organization advocating on behalf of nearly 1 million women-owned businesses representing 68 business organizations. WIP provides timely economic policy information and identifies important trends and opportunities to its membership. Give Me Five is a national program from WIP and American Express Open designed to educate women business owners on how to apply for and secure federal procurement opportunities with the goal of increasing the representation of women business owners that win government contracts. And we're going to be getting started in just a moment with the briefing. But first, I do have a few brief housekeeping notes. First, we are recording this presentation and we'll be sending out a podcast this call to all attendees. For audio quality, the lines are muted so that only presenters can be heard, but we will allot time at the end of the call for Q&A. And now, in order for us to open the lines for Q&A, it is important that you do not put your phone on hold during this call. We understand that you may need to step away, but we ask that you please hang up and call back in if you need to do so, and this is going to ensure that we have a clear line for callers to ask questions at the end. So with those technical notes, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Cela Villaseñor to introduce today's session.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. Today we bring you a special presentation on the extensive changes to contracting policies that were recently passed in the National Defense Authorization Act, removal of the cap on WSB awards, increased surety bonds, fraud prevention measures, and more. Emily Murphy, who is at the head of who was at the heart of the House Committee on Small Businesses reform efforts, has joined us to discuss the changes we will see in 2013 and how they'll affect your business. And I have the pleasure of being here with Emily and Corey Cook, who is also an expert for the House Committee on Small Business on procurement here in their office, and it's my pleasure to introduce her. Emily Webster Murphy is Senior Counsel to the Committee on Small Business in the U.S. House of Representatives. She specializes in contracting and workforce issues. This is Ms. Murphy's second time with the committee, where she worked on government contracting, lending, and telecommunication issues in the 1990s. In the interim, Ms. Murphy has focused on federal procurement issues, most recently spending 4 years as the Chief Counsel and Vice President for Operations at a startup satellite telecommunications company. In addition to her time practicing as a government contracts lawyer, Ms. Murphy served as the Associate Administrator for Government Contracting at the U.S. Small Business Administration and as the Chief Acquisition Officer at the U.S. General Services Administration. Ms. Murphy is a graduate of Smith College and the University of Virginia School of Law, and as I mentioned before, she has been at the heart of this contracting reform package that the House Committee on Small Business passed and saw through the 112th Congress, and we look forward to all the work she's going to do for us and to help women entrepreneurs in this Congress. And with that, I turn it over to our honored guest, Emily.
Thanks, Cela. I'm trying to figure out where to start because there's a lot of information in the small business section of the reauthorization. I'm going to start at the very beginning and just work my way through titles B and C or subtitles B and C of Title 16 of the Act, because that's where you'll find all these various reforms. And please, at the end, ask me questions about it. Some of these are going to be more interesting and useful than others, I'm sure. The first couple of provisions that we worked on deal with DOD specifically, and so they're only applicable there. And specifically making sure that small businesses have the appropriate representation and responsibilities roles within DOD. As you all know, DOD accounts for about 70% of federal contract spending, so its role, you know, its importance can't be exaggerated. The first provision was Section 1611, which actually requires that the Secretary of Defense issue guidance that appoints the Director of Small Business Programs, which we usually refer to as the OSDBU, but DOD has given it a different title, so it's no longer the Office of Small and Disadvantaged Business Utilization. It's the Office of Small and Disadvantaged Business Programs. It requires that the Secretary issue guidance having that the OSDBU participate as early as possible in the procurement process, appointing them to the Defense Technology Board, getting more involved in the acquisition policy practice itself, and overall making sure that the OSDBU is a critical part of the acquisition process itself. The other thing that's really specifically DOD change that may be interesting to some of you is actually that it would create a ombudsman for small businesses at DOD audit agencies such as DCAA and DCMA. Now, these are not individuals who will actually be conducting audits, but they're there to help small businesses who are trying to navigate the audit process and trying to get their audits resolved. Because we've heard from a lot of small businesses that the length and the complexity of the audits itself can be incredibly burdensome to begin with, but also can act as a barrier to going after additional contracts. So we're hoping that that's going to help address that issue. Briefly, some of the other DOD provisions deal with restoring 1% funding for the commercialization part readiness program from the SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Program, and then also making sure that requiring the DOD do some studies. They're required to be under contract by the end of February and then have a report back to Congress by the end of the year, looking at everything from how goals are created at DOD for small business utilization, the role of mid-sized companies at DOD, whether or not there is, you know, how we're allowing small businesses to transition, what kind of opportunities small businesses get as subcontractors at DOD, and really trying to take an in-depth look at how small businesses form a crucial part of the industrial base within in DOD and trying to make sure that that's protected. I think that that report's going to be actually very important because it's going to help us as we try and formulate some of our next steps. The rest of the programs I'm going to talk about are actually government-wide. And the first of those is actually looking at, you know, the first few of those actually look at things at the small business advocates themselves. I'm going to start by talking about the Procurement Center representatives. And I'm not sure if everyone knows what the Procurement Center representatives or the PCRs are, but they're SBA employees who are contract specialists. They're located at other federal agencies or have responsibility for federal agency procurement, and they review any acquisition plan that is not being set aside for small business, or they try to. There are 58 of them, and they're about $530 billion in federal spending, and they're good, but they're not that good. I don't think anyone could review that much. There was a GAO report that was issued in 2011 that looked at the PCR job description and, you know, whether the PCRs were able to live up to it. And based on that, the committee went in and did a dive on the PCRs and found that the job description really hadn't been updated since the 1970s. And while lots of great things came out of the 1970s, it still did predate the federal acquisition regulations and many of the important procurement reforms that we've seen in the last 20 years. So we wanted to make sure that the job description prioritized and focused the PCRs, who are a limited resource, on the areas where they could deliver the most bang for the buck for small businesses. So we required that they be involved earlier in the acquisition planning process. That we require that the acquisition plans that agencies are issuing specifically address how small businesses are going to be utilized. You can't wait till the end and then mitigate that and add in that mitigation. We increase the training that's required for the PCRs that are going to be required over the next 5 years. All of them will have to become level 3 contract specialists, which highest level of contract specialists that there is in the federal government, so they'll be better able to negotiate. We also made some changes. There used to be breakout PCRs and regular PCRs, and breakout PCRs are supposed to look at engineering type of solutions and look at what could be broken out, for example, from the Joint Strike Fighter that could be performed as a prime contract by small business. But since we weren't finding that program was actually delivering many results, and frankly, those breakout PCRs were supposed to be engineers, and SBA was down to having only one breakout PCR left, we thought that instead we should be focusing the PCRs in the areas where small businesses could achieve the greatest results. So while the Small Business Act previously directed SBA to not look at commercial-type contracts when deploying their PCRs, we thought that that actually was an important area for PCRs to be focusing on because a lot of the goods and services that are being bought by the government now are for commercial types of goods and services. I think the last report I saw was over 60% of spending is being directed in that way. So we wanted to make sure that the PCRs were there where the money was. That doesn't mean we don't want them looking at the government-specific functions, because we clearly want them there. But since it's easier for small business to break in on those commercial type of items and services, we want to make sure that we've got that opportunity as well. The other issues that we addressed in that section deal additionally with education, specifically how the contracting officers themselves are trained. And one of our complaints had always been that contracting officers are not required to take a course in small business contracting. There was one that was offered as an elective, but it was only offered as an elective once you hit level three. So contracting officers who were responsible for lower dollar volume contracts were the one, weren't getting training on small business contracting, but those being trained on the most complex procurements were at least able to access that training. We wanted to make sure that that wasn't the case, so going forward, all contracting officers will have to have small business contracting training. And the business opportunity specialists at SBA, who are the crucial in making sure AA companies get the necessary awards, are also going to be required to have a level one contracting specialist certification, which they haven't had in the past. I know I'm missing some additional items we did with the PCRs, but it was fun to go in and dive into that and see what we could do to really try and make these advocates the most effective. Oh, I know what I'm forgetting. The other thing we did was we told them that we think having PCRs train the contracting officers is important, and that's one of the things when we looked at SBA's report on how the PCRs spent their time. The number one thing that the PCRs had down was that they were doing training. And training is great. Clearly, we just talked about how we were requiring training in all of these different aspects. However, the federal government already funds the Federal Acquisition Institute and the Defense Acquisition University, as well as several agency-specific training institutes for contracting officers. We don't have much money to deal with PCRs, and so when we take them and we deploy them to do something that, frankly, agencies and the FAI DAU should be doing on their own, it means we're diverting them from actually reviewing acquisition plans and making sure small businesses get contracts. So we said that the PCRs can engage in training, but only to the extent that it doesn't interfere with their other responsibilities. We then looked at the small business goals. And Chairman Graves has been a great advocate for raising the small business goal to 25%. We passed that out of committee. We got it included in the defense authorization on the House side, and it passed the House of Representatives. When we got to the Senate objected to raising the goal. And so we were unable to get them to compromise with us on that. All we were able to do was get a requirement that senior executives and that the military equivalent of those senior executives, their bonuses going forward and their performance plans have to be based at least in part on meeting the small business goals. So to be fully successful, they're going to have demonstrated that they're working to meet the small business goals, that it's something that's measured and watched and is critical, not just for those individuals in contracting fields, but also for individuals who are working in technology and program management, or overseeing any type of operation that is actually buying things. Because a contracting officer can only purchase what its customer tells it needs. So if I'm a contracting officer and the CIO comes to me and says, I need one solution that provides help desk support globally, I can't tell that the CIO that they're wrong, that that's not what they need. But at the same time, I can argue that that's a bundle. Couldn't you use multiple contractors to achieve that as long as we had the right service level agreements? But if the program manager is set on having one specific product delivered, it's very hard for the contracting officer to negotiate that. Therefore, it's important that it not just be contracting's responsibility to meet the small business goals. It needs to be everyone in leadership's responsibility to meet those goals. The other thing that we were able to do was expand the base for goaling. Right now, when SBA calculates whether or not it met the small business goals, whether we got 23% small business, whether women got 5%, whether SDBs got 5%, whether hub zones got 3%, and whether service-disabled veterans got 3% of federal spending, they do so by first removing dollars from the amount that the federal government spent. And to be a little bit clearer, As I said, the government spends about $530 billion a year. And if you looked at 23% of that, you'd think that, all right, 23%, you know, would be about $115 billion, I think. However, the way that SBA has been calculating the numbers, they've instead taken about $100 billion off the top first. So when they're calculating whether or not they meet the 23%, they're only calculating that based on about $400 billion in spending. And they do that by saying that there's certain types of contracts that are not suitable for award to small business. Interestingly, out of that $100 billion that they removed from the going base, small businesses already receive about 10%. So they can't be that not suitable for award to small business. We tried to get all of those exclusions taken out. We weren't successful in doing that, but we did get some of the exclusions removed. So going forward, an agency cannot argue that because the FAR does not apply to them, that they shouldn't be in the going base. An agency can't say that a certain category of work, types of work, such as utility contracting, shouldn't be included in the going base. An agency can't say that a contract that's funded through use of something other than appropriated dollars, because sometimes the agency will award a contract, but the payments to the contractor doesn't come from the agency. They can't argue that those contracts are no longer subject to the goaling. And we think by doing that, we'll actually be adding back not all of the $100 billion, but a good part of that $100 billion. I mean, if we wanted to get all $100 billion, we'd have to add back in the Unicor program and the Ability One program, and the largest portion is the contracts that are awarded and performed overseas. So that we'd have a full goaling base, and we're going to continue to work on that. As I said, we wanted to raise the goal to 25%. Instead, we've got the Office of Advocacy is supposed to be coming out with a RFP by the end of the month that's asking for research into what is the appropriate small business goal and how can we set goals so that we improve the health of our industrial base. How can we make sure that the goals that we're setting are actually, you know, are geared towards bringing in small businesses and making sure we're prepared to deal with issues of national defense, that we have enough competition, that we have enough small business participation. We're expecting that that study is going to come back by the end of the year, at which point in time I expect that the chairman will be introducing additional legislation to look at raising the goal again and probably look at some of these goaling-based exclusions, some of these issues, some more. I'm going to move on to mentor-protege now. I apologize. I feel like I'm reading a laundry list to you all. But one of the other things the committee was looking at last year was, do mentor-protege programs help small businesses? Are they a good tool? And SBA has its 8A mentor-protege program. The Small Business Act told it that it needed, Small Business Jobs Act said, establish a similar program for women, service-disabled veterans, and hub zones. And then you've got 13 other mentor-protege programs throughout the government. You have one at DOD, and you've got one at, you know, another 12 other agencies. DOD has statutory authority for their mentor-protege program. So we didn't want to address that program. We wanted to make sure that that remained there. DOD also, frankly, has money to help fund its mentor-protege program. And it's always tough to take away money that's going to benefit small business for the sake of uniformity. But they've got statutory authority that addresses how their program operates. And while we sometimes have some, we're not always in complete agreement over it, it seems to be a fairly effective program, and GAO's reports came back and said that it seems to be doing a pretty good job. The other agencies, GAO found that there wasn't a very good metric for success, that there was a lot of disparity in the rules that were governing those programs. And I sat down and read all the mentor-protege programs. I do not advise doing this. It's not a good way to spend your evening. But found that in some cases, the mentor-protege agreements or programs being administered by other agencies were telling mentors and protégés, so large and small businesses, to engage in activities that would actually, if considered by the SBA, would make the small business no longer a small business. And to me, that's criminal. We should not be, the government shouldn't be telling small businesses, act this way, it'll help you get a contract, now we're going to punish you for having done what we just told you to do. So we tried to take an approach to look at this. We didn't want to take programs away from agencies, but we needed some guidance. The first thing we did was add to that 8A mentor-protege program and the Jobs Act requirement that they add the additional mentor-protege program. Say, all right, SBA, we want you to run your own small business mentor-protege program that's a government-wide program. Model it on the other programs, but make sure that if we're, you know, that we've got opportunities for all small businesses here. Furthermore, SBA, they're directed now to issue regulations telling every agency that's running a mentor-protege program what the minimum standard for those programs will be. How do we treat affiliation? How do we make sure that the mentor isn't exploiting the protege? How do we make sure that the protege is actually gaining skills? Can we track the protege and make sure that they're actually getting more contracts and will be able to compete independently for more contracts in the future? So SBA is going to have to issue those regulations. Agencies will then have a year to submit a revised program to SBA for approval. SBA then can approve that program. And one of the things we've asked SBA to look at in approving these programs is there a way for someone who gets into, say, the DHS mentor-protege program to be able to transfer that agreement to another agency and use that same agreement elsewhere so that we don't ask small businesses and the companies who are trying to invest in those small businesses to do unnecessarily duplicative paperwork. So, you know, can we add some portability to these programs? We're looking forward to seeing the results of this. I met with SBA this morning on this issue, and I'm really hopeful that we're going to see something that gives small businesses some good tools. The next thing we looked at was subcontracting. And subcontracting for small businesses hits in two ways. First of all, how do small businesses themselves subcontract, and how do small businesses get subcontracts? The first one, there's always been something called the limitation on subcontracting clause in all federal contracts that are set-asides. It says that if you get a set-aside contract, the small business has to perform 50% of the cost of the labor or 50% of the cost of production itself. Makes sense. You want to make sure that if we're setting something aside, if we're excluding other sources, the government then said that we think that there's a real value to having small businesses or women-owned small businesses perform this contract. We want to make sure that they're actually performing the contract, that it's not just being passed through to a large business. However, the way that the rule was written in the past, it was cost-based. So to note, if a small business wanted to comply, and I think WIP actually provided us with some great testimony on this, they had to know not only their own cost basis, but the cost basis of each of their subcontractors. And there isn't a subcontractor out there who wants to give their prime contractor their cost basis. Oddly enough, it undermines their negotiating powers they've got and their independence. So we told small businesses, here's the rule, we want you to comply with it, but we've set up an accounting system by which you can't comply with it. That penalized small businesses who tried to comply because they would then do, out of an abundance of caution, try to do too much work or more work than they were required to, which may not be the best business decision for them. But it also made it easier for large businesses who were trying to exploit this to hide behind a small business because no one could ever catch them unless it was a truly egregious example. And we saw some where there was a company with 3 employees that got a $75 million services contract and claimed that it was going to perform the work itself. I want that labor hour rate because that must be an amazingly lucrative job to have. So what we've changed it from now, so instead of counting cost, going forward we're going to look at price. And we're going to say that a small business can only subcontract up to 50% of the amount it receives on the contract. However, that small business can subcontract to other small businesses, and we won't punish them for that. That can count towards the 50% that they have to keep to themselves. Because if the intention of the law is to make sure that small businesses are getting the benefit of the set-aside contract, then having small businesses team together makes sense because we can let them go after larger contracts. And if together the small businesses are doing 50% of the work, the government gets the value and the benefit. This also should allow more small business teaming, And it means that when a small business becomes other than small, the day that it gets an extra employee or extra dollars, and it's a large business, it should have a good group of small business subcontractors to work with, so it'll have a good subcontracting plan going forward. We won't be asking someone to rewrite their business model just because their size changed. I think that that's particularly important also to note that the way that it works, we're going to say similarly situated entities, you can subcontract to another similarly situated entity. So if you're a woman-owned small business, you can subcontract to another woman-owned small business if it's a woman-owned small business set-aside. If it's a 8A sole source contract, you can subcontract to other 8As without there being a penalty. If it's a small business contract, you can subcontract to other small businesses without there being a penalty. The reverse side of this, though, is how do we track it? And there's already a requirement that says that all businesses awarding subcontracts over $25,000 are supposed to be recording those in the federal subcontracting reporting system. So we looked at it and said, we don't want to add a new paperwork burden for small businesses. SBA administration, figure out how to use the existing subcontracting reporting system and get that information. This is a different system than the electronic subcontracting reporting system that SBA runs that allows large businesses to report their small business contracting. But it, as I said, it's been a law. It was actually it passed into law in 2006 when then-Senator Obama and Senator Coburn worked together on creating that database. So we're going to try and put that database to some good use. Now, the reverse side of this is what about when small businesses are subcontractors? And we've got, you know, we talk a lot about the small business prime contracting goal, but there's a small business subcontracting goal, 35.9%. We've actually directed SBA to go back and revisit that goal and to make sure that it's an increasing goal rather than a decreasing goal, because right now it's a decreasing goal, and that is problematic. But how do we make sure that the subcontracting really delivers opportunities for small businesses? And one of the ways we did that was we changed how subcontracting plans are going to operate. We require that SBA do a better job and agencies do a better job of making sure that contractors who have subcontracting plans actually file subcontracting reports. In the past, the committee found that about 30% of those companies don't file the report. So they can come in and promise that 40% of the subcontract opportunities will go to small business, and we don't know if they've succeeded. We don't know if they got $0 to small business or if they, you know, did 80% of their work with small business, because no one's filing a report. And we need that information to know whether or not the programs are successful. We've also asked SBA to start collecting information on which industries are getting subcontracts. So are the subcontracts going to companies that are in the same industry that the prime contractor got the work in? So if it's a technology contract, is the subcontract going to a small woman-owned technology company, or is it going to office supplies and building maintenance? And this isn't to say that one is right and one is wrong, but we need to know that, because if we're using subcontracting as a tool to build the industrial base, we want to make sure that we're hitting each of the segments of the industrial base. We've also required that SBA create a mechanism where small businesses can report if they believe that their prime contractor is acting in bad faith, and we can have some sort of investigation and some sort of recourse for those businesses. I think that combined with the rule we're expecting from SBA on subcontracting after the 2010 Jobs Act should really change how subcontracting operates. And finally, on subcontracting, we've required that in the past there was actually a provision in the Small Business Act that said that prime contractors who had subcontracting opportunities were supposed to publish those in the Commerce Business Daily. And I'm guessing most people don't remember the Commerce Business Daily because it hasn't existed since 1999. But the Small Business Act was never updated, and so the only place that SBA provided for that to be published was on their own subnet contracting site. There were very few opportunities there, and so we said instead that we need to give prime contractors access to the same place that we're publishing prime contracting opportunities, which would be SBO. And so that if you're a subcontractor and you're interested in competing for subcontracts, you know where those subcontracts are to be found. Next thing we looked at was insourcing. And I'll tell you, the committee wanted to give small businesses the ability to challenge insourcing decisions, especially if it was done for commercial, if the agency was suggesting that it was saving money. We thought that small businesses should have the same rights that agency employees have under the A76 process, in which case the agency employees under when something's being outsourced can challenge it to GAO. We suggested that small businesses who are losing their contracts to insourcing should have the right to go to GAO and challenge the decision-making process. We were not successful with this. We got it passed in the House. We did not get it through in the Senate. What we compromised on was that at least agencies are going to have to start publishing the guidance and the rules and the regulations that they use to make insourcing decisions. I dealt with more than one small business who has had to FOIA the decision-making process for insourcing. And there should never be a secret process by which you lose a contract or lose the ability to compete. So I think that's going to be an important change. And I think it's something that we're not giving up on. We're going to continue to work to make sure that small business opportunities are protected. One of the things I think we're going to look at during this Congress is when do small businesses get notified that the work that they're performing is being considered for insourcing. We've dealt with some agencies who've told us they make the decision up to a year before they tell the small business, because otherwise the small business would stop performing. I've suggested to them that in which case they would have lots of recourse. And they clearly have so little esteem for small business that they really do think that if a small business knows it's being considered for insourcing, that it'll just walk away. That's a business that's not going to stay in business very long, and that does not reflect my experience of dealing with small businesses when I've been at agencies. They've always been wonderful performers. Move on to one of the fundamental questions for all small business, which is, what is small? We were concerned last Congress that SBA, as it's been revisiting and revising its size standards, which we applaud them for doing, they're required under law now to revisit each size standard every 5 years. SBA was taking their size standards, though, and combining different industries together to try and come up with a size standard. As an example, SBA looked at architects who previously had a $4.5 million size standard and looked at engineers who previously had a $14 million size standard and proposed combining them into one size standard of $19 million. We talked to the architects, we talked to the engineers, and they filed comments with SBA, went in and talked to SBA, explained to them that for architects in particular, that would mean that over 98% of architects were going to be considered small. They said, you're measuring the wrong thing. When you measure us with engineering firms, you're looking at two different types of companies. And frankly, for architects, you should probably be looking at something other than our receipts. You should be looking at how many employees we have. How many architects do we have? SBA didn't agree. SBA, we got them to back down on the size standard for architects to $9 million. But in other industries, they were combining their size standards. So, for example, IT professional services, there were a series of industries where SBA's own analysis indicated that the appropriate size standard should be $35 million. SBA instead gave them a $25.5 million size standard because that made it simpler to have only one IT services size standard. That's not what the Small Business Act was intended to do. What SBA is directed to do under the Act is actually look at each industry, figure out for that industry what is the appropriate size standard, whether it be number of employees, whether it be receipts, whether it be something else. When we look at small banks, we look at how much they lend. When we look at small refineries, how much oil do they produce? So look at each industry individually. And if the industries together do have the same size standard, fine, issue a joint size standard. But otherwise, give each industry its own size standard so that you can do the best job possible of reflecting small rather than either under the proposed rules SBA has gone out with. In some cases, their own analysis says that they're going to be calling large businesses small businesses for this convenience purpose, or they're going to be taking businesses that their own analysis says are legitimate small businesses and not letting them compete as small businesses. So we're hopeful that this is going to address that issue. Contract bundling. this is one of Chairman Gray's other big priorities. It's probably the issue that I think he hears about the most and talks about the most, because he's really concerned that we've got contracts that we're not allowing small businesses to compete, and that when we don't allow small businesses to compete, we end up paying more than we have to. What he proposed doing was twofold, well, threefold actually. He proposed taking the contract bundling and the contract consolidation rules that are out there right now and combining them into one program so that we don't make agencies do duplicative reviews, but instead trying to make that one review a meaningful review, one that looked at not just work that's previously been performed by small businesses, but looked at new requirements also and whether they were suitable for performance by small business. We wanted something that looked at the reporting requirements that are out there right now and make sure we were getting the right data so we can assess whether or not contract bundling is being done in a responsible way. Because in some cases, bundling does save money. In a lot of cases, all it does is make things easier for the agency to administer. And so the Small Business Act is always distinguished between justified bundling and unjustified bundling. Because it's so hard to catch unjustified bundling, he proposed also allowing not just small businesses, but small business trade associations to protest bundled contracts at GAO. And we got a firestorm of comment from the administration on that. As many of you know, GAO is actually an agency of Congress. And it's the first time I can ever recall the administration telling us that we were giving GAO too much work, because it's more or less saying you're giving your employees too much work. Given the protests, even though it passed the House, it did not pass the Senate. Instead, what we got was improved contract consolidation language that lowers the thresholds for review. So we're going to be reviewing more contracts to see if they are consolidated and make sure that it will get more opportunities for small business that way. And we're asking GAO to go back and look at the cases we've got right now, the reports, information, and figure out whether or not agencies are actually complying with the rules on bundling. I think that once that report comes out, you're going to see some additional legislation from the committee. Let me talk a little bit about the fraud provisions. One of the things that defense authorization does is make it easier to prosecute companies that misrepresent themselves as small, as women-owned, as hub zones, any type of small business, by making it easier to go into suspension and debarment with them. It no longer requires that the misrepresentation be evidence that they're not presently responsible. Instead, it can be de facto evidence for suspension or debarment. And that's important because it'll let SBA go after some companies that have been acting in bad faith. However, we didn't want to dissuade companies that are acting in good faith from continuing to do so, even if they have complicated organizational structures. So what Mr. Kaufman from Colorado had suggested when we worked on this is an individual bill for him was allowing advisory opinions. So we suggested having outside counsel do advisory opinions and a business be able to use that not as proof that they are small, but at least as proof that they weren't acting in bad faith if they're ever found to be other than small. There was concern on the Senate side that people would start going to relatives who are attorneys and having them write the letters, and they would be meaningless. I'm not sure I agree with that argument, but instead the decision was made that the advisory opinions would instead could be issued by a Small Business Development Center or by a Procurement Technical Assistance Center, an SBDC or a PTAC. They're not required to issue those letters, but if they do, they have to send a copy and file it with SBA. And if SBA does not reject the letter, then the business can use it as evidence that it's acting in good faith. Additionally, with the fraud, we've asked that SBA actually publish its standard operating procedures on suspension and debarment, report back to us each year on suspension and debarment, how it's operating with it, and actually put on its website the name of a suspension and debarment official, because right now it's very hard to find that information for SBA. We have not yet been able to get a copy of their standard operating procedures. I started off by talking about the Offices of Small and Disadvantaged Business Utilization, or OSDA booth at DOD. We also looked at the OSDA booth government-wide, and we've been concerned that the OSDA booths were, in some agencies, being demoted. the Small Business Act requires the OSDB report directly to the head of the agency or the deputy head of the agency, secretary or deputy secretary. At some agencies, we were finding that the individual who was the OSDB was also the chief acquisition officer, the chief financial officer, the chief information officer, the chief human capital officer, sometimes the chief of staff, and one of numerous other titles. But the person actually carrying out the functions was three or four levels down in the food chain. And that meant the person who was reviewing things and trying to protect small business was having to protest decisions being made by contracting to the same person who was running contracting. That does not maintain the independence that the Small Business Act envisioned for OSDBs. So instead, we've required that the OSDB have only the job of OSDB, that the OSDB indeed be the equivalent of the chief acquisition officer, paid the same amount as the chief acquisition officer if there is one. If not, they have to be at least a GS-15. So they're going to be a senior federal employee. We clarified their role in acquisition planning. We clarified their role in helping agencies review insourcing decisions to try and mitigate the effect on small businesses. And we also looked at their travel and conference and training work. So, again, it's great to have them providing training. We want to make sure, though, that since they're the first line of defense against acquisition strategies that keep small businesses from competing, that their first job be to be in the agencies, monitoring the agencies. And so we've asked them to report back to us and to make sure that training is only done as a supplement to their other duties, that instead that they need to be focusing on the acquisition work itself. Quickly, surety bonding. Previously, there was a cap on the size of a surety bond that SBA could guarantee, and it was $2.5 million, and we've increased that to $6.5 million. We found that the average size of construction contract awarded by the government to a small business was between $5 and $6 million. So to have bonding that was only going up to a third of that amount was not actually providing small businesses with the assistance they needed, especially as the government's been moving to more of the multiple award task order contracts for construction, where they were having higher bonding requirements. And we were able to do so without actually raising, it's not going to cost the government any more money to actually raise that cap. We've now pegged it to the set-aside cap for sole source cap for 8As. So it'll continue to increase with inflation. One of the most important things we did was we finally removed the dollar caps on the women's set-aside program. So instead of women being required to only being able to get set-asides for contracts under $4 million or $6.5 million in the case of manufacturing, now as long as there are two women-owned small businesses who otherwise qualify for the program, the contract can be whatever size the contracting officer determines is appropriate so that we can actually have some real progress in the program. The fact that the program was only getting under $100 million in contracts to be being generous showed that it really wasn't an effective program as it was previously crafted. The other important part of that, though, is that SBA is directed to revisit its study on which industries have underrepresentation of women and substantial underrepresentation of women. So in what industries can we have set aside for women? And they're required to update that study every 5 years so that we'll have more opportunities for the program to actually reflect the reality that women are facing. There's some other dribs and drabs. I don't mean to make light of them, but, for example, allowing the Northern Mariana Islands to participate in an export grant program, things like that, I don't think are of particular interest to you all, but I'd be happy to talk about them if they are. But otherwise, I'm going to stop talking because you've heard me for 40 minutes straight now. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask the first question here. It's a question that I've heard from a number of people now, and the question relates to, your best estimate on when the changes to the WSB program would be implemented. I know WIP has sent a letter to the SBA encouraging them to be implemented as quickly as possible. So what are your thoughts on that?
So my thoughts are that this rule should be, they should be able to implement it as either an interim final or final regulation. There's not any discretion that needs to go into this. It's, this is not something that's subject to comment under the, you know, Administrative Procedures Act. So this should be a very simple change for SBA. That said, even once they have the, you know, they have to draft something up, just basically striking those changes. They need to send it over, clear it through the building, send it to OMB. OIRA will give all the agencies and anyone else 90 days to comment on it, at which point in time I would expect it to be published. So I'd say that I'd look at 6 months. It's important, though, that everyone recognize that SBA changing its rules is not going to be enough. The federal acquisition regulations also need to be changed. And so making sure the FAR Council starts a case on that as soon as possible and makes those changes, ideally concurrently with SBA, is very important. We've talked to both SBA and to OFPP about this. I believe the Women's Caucus here is also sending them a letter, and we're hoping that this can be done by the, you know, within the next 6 months.
Great, thank you.
That said, we're still waiting on rules from SBA from the 2010 Jobs Act, and it's 2013. So.
Great, thank you, Emily. Does anybody else have a question?
Emily, well, this is Barbara Kassoff, and while we're waiting for any questions to come in, I just want to thank you again so much for your leadership, your hard work, your extraordinary knowledge. Every time we have the opportunity to talk with you and have you at one of our meetings or on the call as you are now, you just share a wealth of information with us. And I want to thank you on behalf of the entire women's business community for all the tremendous support and knowledge that you had and the hard work to make these issues dealt with and a reality. You certainly have carried our voice forward, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Barbara. I've got a great chairman for. So I'm sorry, someone had a question?
Yes. I was just wondering, would it be possible to get a brief summary of all the points you covered today? Is there such a thing that exists out there? Because you've done a great job of explaining them, but I need to pass this information along to our congressional delegations, and they're asking for some of it, even though I know they get it, but they ask it from a, you know, from a constituency point of view.
This is Cielo. I will make sure and send something out to all of you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
No problem.
And just as a reminder, if anybody has a question they'd like to ask, you can push *6 on your keypad in order to be heard.
I think the 45 minutes of me talking lulled everyone to sleep.
Can you hear me? I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, this is Elizabeth Birch. I just was wondering if you also look at the issues associated with the 8A certification and how they have the gender bias classification, that women in disadvantaged industries or industries that are underrepresented can apply for that. I know there's been a trend that that's gone down where they haven't approved as many, so I don't know if you've looked at those issues.
Looked at it. There's actually an interesting GAO case, I think it was, within the last week or so, where SBA was told they had to go back and revisit the issue. So it's something we've been monitoring. Unless we have specific cases, it's harder to say that, you know, the SBA is behaved inappropriately in doing it. We don't see the facts of each individual case. So if you know of cases where that's happening, please let me know.
Great. Thank you so much.
No problem.
And this is Gloria. May I ask a question?
Of course.
Okay, great. Emily, thank you so much. It's not that we don't have any questions. It's just that we are swimming in information that you just gave us. And you are fabulous at everything you're doing. My question is, would you be so kind, or Cielo be so kind as to summarize these key points and send them out to us so that we can really spend some time in digesting them and what they mean to our business?
Hi, Gloria. This is Cielo. Yes, I will be sending out a summary of everything we discussed here. And, you know, we were lucky enough to have Emily talk about all the details, but we can certainly condense it to make sure you have a little guide going forward.
That would be extraordinarily helpful. And, Emily, you have done a second what Barbara mentioned. You're in this every day, so you may not realize just how much it's affecting all of us out there in the trenches trying to do a good job with our business. So everything that you do is creating a legacy for us. Thank you.
Thank you. The next step is making sure that the regulations that come out actually implement the programs properly, and that's going to be quite a battle unto itself to make sure that we get these implemented in a way that benefits small businesses.
And you can count on us to be right behind you.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to need everyone here to be commenting on these rules and watching them. Yes.
Thank you so much, Gloria.
Sure.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining today's call. I wanted to just reiterate that we will be sending out the podcast of this, and I want to thank everybody on behalf of WIP and the Give Me 5 program as well for joining us today.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all very much for having me.